This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The devil comes to visit you and he says, hey, you're going to have one good tournament. I'm going to give you one, right? That's it. You're going to, what would it be?
Ooh,
don't know why it's the devil.
Yeah. Well, see, it is the opposite to the golfing gods, because the golfing gods are never really on our side, are they? But I think...
1, 2, 3, 4. Another beautiful day on the Victor Bravo Golf Course. The sun is shining, the birds are about, and there's a sudden buzz in the crowd. Michael Michelson steps up to the tee box. 15th hole here, driver's recommended. Oh, is he a caveman? Because he suddenly clubbed that one. What do you reckon, George? I mean, did he hit that with a dictionary? Because that was a terrible read.
Well, g'day, and this is golf. Andrew Daddo's my name, professional golfing enthusiast. Love it. And this is the Journeyman episode. And I don't think it'll be the last one I'll do, because I really enjoyed it. A little later on, how to hit a draw. It tips, they come from the strangest places, and this one is a doozy. But from the tip giver, his golfing life has changed dramatically. Like, literally, he's a new person. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you could subscribe and review and even give us a 5-star rating, because that helps other people find us and share the love. So this week, the Journeyman to the far west of Australia and Carramar Golf Club. I clicked on the link to look at the photographs of the course before looking at the website. Lots of kangaroos, and there's one that I thought had a Joey's foot sticking out of its back end. It wasn't, though. It was an enormous set of testicles, which was quite funny, quite surprising. I thought, better put those away or someone will turn them into a wallet or a key ring. You might have seen those. Now, Carramar is near Joondalup. It's north of Perth. And the pro there is Glenn Paul, who I don't know, but now I feel that I do, and I'm really thankful for the time we had together. It's an interesting story, his. It's one of self-belief and trust, and he's got a lot to offer all of us about the game of golf and, you know, having a go, just trying and seeing what you can achieve. We started chatting about his introduction to the game. I hope you enjoy it. This is Glenn Paul, and the podcast is Golf.
Grew up in Campbelltown, or Macquarie Fields to be exact. So, yeah, Sydney boy, and played golf for your Sydney listeners at RAE Golf Club, which is now closed down there in Moorbank. So grew up playing my golf there. Started when I was about 6 or 7. And I think I kind of just fell into it. My next door neighbor at the time was the club secretary there, and took me out for a game, and fell in love with it, and kind of just kind of kicked on from there. And I think the turning point for me, or the point where I really kind of thought that I wanted to play professionally, I was actually at the Cannon Challenge in 1996. So that would have been at Terry Hills. I think Castle Hill was the year after. It might have been Castle Hill, might have been 98 potentially. But I just remember coming from this 9-hole 18 tee golf course in a military barracks to going out to Terry Hills. And I remember walking through the front gates and this pristine manicured golf course, guys out there playing for, I don't even think the prize money was that great for the Cannon Challenge back in the 90s. But to me, anything more than 10 bucks seemed like a million. So these guys are playing for great coin out on this fantastic golf course. And I was pinching myself. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. So that for me was where I really kind of thought, you know what? I really want to do this as a career. I want to play golf and make money and travel the world. And really from there, just sort of dedicated the rest of my life to doing that and pursuing that goal. So it's been an interesting journey from there and a few ups and plenty of downs. But
okay, so that sounds like the life of a professional golfer. Tell me,
that's true.
The money. Right. So, because I mean, like, I write books, for instance, and everyone says never write books for money because your heart won't be in it. So you've got to write from from here. And I'm guessing golf's kind of the same, but it was the prize money at the beginning, was it? That's the thing you went, holy cow. Look, oh my God.
Yeah. I think definitely the prize money, but also just playing on this a really immaculate golf course and having people come out and watch you and want to get your autograph and want to talk to you. And it's not so much about being a celebrity as such, but I think it was just a different atmosphere and a different experience that I'd ever sort of been in and around. And it was something that I definitely found very attractive. And obviously, yeah, the money's a bonus as part of that.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm talking to Glenn Paul, Carramar Golf Club, north of Perth. Glenn, how old were you at that point and when did you decide to hit up America?
Yeah, so 96. I would have been 12 back then. So,
yeah, okay, right, of course, yeah, great.
Yeah, and you said young at the start in the intro, which I'm quite flattered about because I feel about 60-something these days. But yeah, I was 12 and... just sort of finishing primary school, and it was a funny sort of time because in primary school I was literally the only kid that played golf, and golf was always the old person sport, and wearing your cardigans and the plus fours, and going into high school I was almost a little apprehensive going into high school, being the only kid in primary school that played golf, and went to Holsworthy High School and got there, and there was about five or six of us that played, so all of a sudden I felt I guess a little bit more of a golf community around me, and a couple of those kids were pretty solid golfers as well. And we kind of pushed each other through high school to achieve a little more. And I think through that journey of high school, still, handicap was coming down, but it was the goal of playing professionally, all of a sudden became a little bit more realistic.
Okay. So you found your tribe. And when did you find out you were actually a good golfer?
I'm still searching for that.
No, but honest. You know what I mean. No, but like there was some point, something happened that turned you on. And I'm thinking, like, with the mind to the amateur golfer, thinking, is there a moment that's going to click for me? And what was yours?
Yeah, I think, and I was never a world beater as a junior and an amateur as well. So I didn't represent state. I didn't go and win any big tournaments. But yeah, I just, there was something inside of me, I think, that just kind of felt that I could have a crack, and I think my backup plan, which was sort of the first plan of attack, was to do a traineeship with a PGA and at least get the qualification behind me. So I started that in 2005 where did I start my time? Nowra Golf Club, a great little golf course down on the south coast there.
Yeah, nice.
And so started there, came back up to Sydney to what was New Brighton Golf Club. And kind of got to 2007, had a few personal issues, health issues, and actually pulled out of the traineeship. And it was sort of that point there that I was still playing okay golf as a trainee. Again, not setting the world alight, but there was that internal belief that I had what it took to go out and make a living from playing golf. And it was, sort of middle of 2007, started 2008, I knew some people in America and I thought, stuff it. I'm just going to pack my bags, take the credit card and go over and just give it a crack, play some mini tours, try and pre-queue for some tournaments and see what comes of it.
So what happened? How'd you go?
Not that great. As I mentioned to you earlier that, yeah, I always look at my career as being somewhat mediocre and never really lived up to my own expectations. And I think that's the same for not just a lot of professional athletes and golfers, but just people in general, that we always have these expectations and ideas of where we want to go with our life. And when we don't quite achieve that, it's very easy to become bitter and twisted, which is probably why there's a lot of bitter and twisted golf pros out there in the world. But I joke around about being a Mars bar salesman, which my wife hates, but it's a bit of an internal joke as far as golf pros go. But it wasn't great.
So you're a Mars bar salesman now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's either folding sweaters or selling Mars bars, but both are probably a little bit better at making money at the moment. But I think for as far as America went, I got over there, US Open qualifying was my first event. So I'd only been in the country a week and was still trying to find my feet, and went out there, was nervous as all hell. Traveled okay. I was traveling okay through the front nine and then just absolutely gassed at the back nine. And
right.
But as far as tournaments go and nerves, I'm not somebody that gets super nervous, but man, that standing on that first tee box, and I pre-queued at Duke University Golf Club, I was so bloody scared. And all that was running through my head was don't top it. And it's funny, and I'm sure we'll get to it, but I like to try and normalize athletes quite a lot. And I think, having worked with other athletes in some of the other work that I do, it's very easy for the amateur golfer or the amateur sports person or your armchair critic to put professional athletes up on a pedestal. And I get why it happens, but at the same time, we're all just normal people and we love to have a beer and we love to go out and just enjoy our lives as well. But we just happen to be really, really good at golf or really, really good at football or whatever else that might be. So, it's funny. So I was really, really nervous, but,
who else was there? Were there other golfers there that you knew that you'd seen on the telly also trying to pre-qualify and this is the whole way through. So, and this is for the Open, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So this was first stage or regional qualifying. So for those that don't know, with US Open qualifying, there's a couple of stages. So you've got a regional or a sectional qualifier, and then you go through to a regional or a final qualifying then to get into the tournament. So this was that sort of first stage. I can't even remember how many people got through, but it's such a money grab for the USGA. The amount of players they actually have go to these sectional qualifyings and the money that you pay to get in, it's an absolute gold mine. But that's how the guys end up paying for seven odd mil.
So. Yeah. So what do you pay to get in?
2008's a long time ago. I struggle to remember yesterday, let alone 2008. I think it was around about 60 or 70 bucks. It wasn't super expensive. Oh, okay.
So it's not too bad.
Yeah. It's not super expensive, but you've got like 10,000 people across the US trying to qualify at this sectional stage. But it was so coming back to how I was thinking on the first tee. Yeah. Like I have those same thoughts and those demons in the back of my mind, like every golfer does. And on that day it was standing on the first, just thinking, don't top it. Some days it's standing over a shot going, don't shank it. Which can be sometimes a regular occurrence, but at the same time managed to nut one away down the middle and got off to a good start. And then same thing, hit a few bad shots and those negative thoughts get in your mind and it just sort of snowballs from there. And it's not even the negative thoughts of thinking that you're a crap golfer. It's starting to think about your golf swing, which, as everybody knows, as golfers, that's probably the number one bad habit. We just start thinking technically and trying to fix our golf swing midway through a round after we've hit what we perceive as being a poor shot.
So you've gassed the back nine, you've left the course and gone, okay, so I'm not playing the US Open this year. What happened then?
After a prime rib burger from Hardee's on the drive home, a few too many of those over there as well. But it was just sort of reassessing and starting to go, well, yeah, shit, have I just wasted all this money and put everything on the line to come over? And I've just, you know, shot an 80, I think I shot like an 82 or an 83 or something. And yeah, I thought I was playing decent golf. So then to go out and shoot in the 80s, that first real event, yeah, it rattled me. But then I had a couple of weeks.
So after one tournament, after one attempt to qualify, you're already going, what am I doing? Really?
Yep. Yeah, right. Absolutely. And it's crazy because I had absolute 100% belief in myself and my abilities, because I wouldn't have got on the plane and gone over there and had a crack in the first place if I didn't truly believe that I could, you know, go out there and compete. But yeah, I had a couple of weeks then to kind of just practice and settle in and get ready for my first tournament. So I was playing on the Tar Heel Tour through the Carolinas, so North Carolina, South Carolina, and up in through Virginia as well. So yeah, had a couple of weeks to kind of prepare. And I was based at Pinehurst, which, yeah, for me,
pretty good.
Heaven. I think they got 9 golf courses there. At the time, there were 8. So pretty much had free reign of sort of 6, 7, and 8. 2 and 4 were a bit tougher to get on, obviously 2 being the flagship course. But yeah, essentially had kind of free reign of the property. And as a player, it's great because you've got just such a varied number of courses and the layouts and the shots that you've got to hit. You can kind of practice and hit every single shot that you need to really practice.
But, and so how much practice did you do? Like, you're on one of the best golfing complexes in the world, literally. So were you grinding it? You know, they say Tigers, you know, 9-hour, 8-hour days, like full day. Were you doing that, or were you said something about burgers before and sort of?
Yeah, burgers for me.
Yeah, what were the traps?
Oh, the American food's just a massive trap. But, you know, burgers for me, after any bad round of golf, that it could even be a pro-am over here. It's if I play poorly, it's straight through Hungry Jack's on the,
yeah, right.
on
okay.
the dry phone.
Fair
but it's just that comfort food. But yeah, look, a normal day for me was normally sort of up, do a bit of a workout, have some breakfast, and then I'd be at the course reasonably early, on the range for a fair chunk of that. You know, I might do sort of 2 or 3 hours on the range, another couple of hours of short game, stop for lunch, and then go out and try and play 9 holes. And that's something that I've carried over, not so much the grinding on the range, but the focus on short game and more so the focus on actually getting out and playing golf is something that I've really kind of carried over through the rest of my career and definitely sort of into my coaching and what I try and encourage other golfers to do as well. And I think, you know, if I could have my time again in America, and we've got plenty more that we can talk about in the States, but I think if I could have my time again, just from an initial point of view, it would be to not think so much about my technique and not spend so much time on the practice fairway and just play more golf and kind of trust in myself a little bit more. So, and that's helped me a lot as I've matured as a player. But I think a level of that has come from that maturity as well.
So you're a believer in the feels of your game as opposed to the technique of your game. And is that what should we be doing that as, you know, like if we're playing once a week or twice a week and we don't practice and we, you know, should we be on the feels?
Yeah, look, I think feels and technique are important. Technique is important to a degree, but at the same time, I say to my clients now that we don't think about throwing a ball and we don't think about, you know, riding a bike and a lot of the other things that we do subconsciously and realistically, the golf swing kind of wants to work the same way in that, you know, I think we overcomplicate the technical aspect and we're always searching for this perfect swing and, yeah, we want to swing it on plane and at the moment, you know, shallowing out and all of these other sort of, you know, pop terms that people use that are massive on Google and Instagram and whatnot at the moment. I think, yeah, for me, there's an element of, I guess, sort of the body and the brain knows how to move a golf club instinctively. So the less we think about it, the more we can actually access our ability to swing it. But then in saying that, you know, we also need to, if you've got aspirations to be a good player or you want to improve the quality of strike or you want to learn how to hit draws and fades, then there's a time and place for the technical aspect and the technical learning. But I think if most golfers just, and this is not saying that, yeah, don't go and see your PGA pro for a lesson, because obviously that's what we're there for, and we want to help golfers get better. But I think that, there's a time and place for it.
Yeah.
And when you do go and get that golf lesson, working on the right points for your game, as opposed to just trying to swing it better, is the key to improvement.
Yeah. See, I wonder about that saying that, you know, like we don't think of, I mean, I agree with you. We don't think about throwing a ball or riding a bike, but dead set, there are people playing golf who this is not a natural game. Right. So
yeah,
I mean, Dane, you've got it. We all need help. It's a question, I suppose, it's a question of how much help we need. I want to go back to America. You said there's other things happen there. So how long did you last? What was your tipping point?
So I was over there for probably about 4 months, which was about two or three months shorter than I was expecting to sort of stay. So I got over there, would have been May, 4 months I was over there. So I got over there early May, came back August, was anticipating a stay sort of October, November. The tipping point for me was that I just ran out of money. And, and I think, and again, you know, in hindsight, I would have factored in a few other expenses that I had at home, and I didn't look at that. It was the shiny lights of America and the PGA Tour, and I was just like, yeah, perfect. Got a credit card. I've got a little bit of money in the bank. I'm just going to just stuff it. Like, I'll go and make some money. So that Aussie she'll be right attitude. And, I didn't factor in that I still had a mobile phone in Australia that I needed to pay for, and a personal loan that needed to be paid for, and all of those sorts of things. And then after 3 months, you're starting to get the phone calls and it's like, shit, okay, well, yeah, I've got to still pay that.
All right. How close did you get to success?
Yeah. In the States, nowhere near it. Right. I missed, I think I played five or six events, missed every cut. And look, the competition was pretty solid on the Tar Heel Tour at the time. So we had, who was playing those years? The one that stands out is like Tommy Two Gloves. He was playing. There are a lot of good players that were either on PGA Tour or on Nationwide or Web.com or whatever it was at the time. If they missed a cut, they would come down and play our events. Or
right.
If they missed a Monday, then they would come down and play our events. So the fields were strong. And I thought my golf was pretty good, but it was just not quite where it needed to be.
Okay, so how much better were those guys, those guys dropping down? So imagine on a sliding scale, if the guys dropping down from the web.com were coming to the Tar Heel and blitzing down there, did you see any guys from the tour? Like, what level of good are they compared to the other, to where you were at the time?
Yeah, look, next level. And I think, you know, for the difference, the biggest difference I see from the top level to Korn Ferry players down to your mini tour players or just any other professional golfer, there's this element of not so much technique, but their execution of shots and their ability to execute on command. Which I guess sort of ties in a little bit into the mental side of it as well. And you've got to be able to trust yourself. So, if you're standing up there and trying to hit, a little slingy draw with trouble down the left, it's such a stupid shot to play at the best of times. But these guys know that they can do it and they can stand up and execute it as well, where you go down a couple of tiers and me trying to hit a draw at the best of times is hard enough, but you know, it's, you stand up there and you aim right and you'll, you know, try and turn it over and it either becomes a snap hook into the water or you hit a big calf cut, and either way you're in trouble. But it's definitely the belief in their ability to actually execute on command, and then just course management and strategy. I think between a player here in Australia on the Aussie tour and the PGA Tour player, ability wise, there's not a huge gap. Yeah, at the end of the day, we can all hit a pretty solid golf ball with some reasonable level of consistency, which is a term I hate using with my clients. But yeah, there's a level of consistency there. But the guys that are playing week in and week out, and you see it here in Australia too, that the guys that are playing and traveling around Australia, playing pro-ams and playing our tour events week in, week out, always play considerably better than, say, like us here in WA that have a pro-am swing of 6 or 8 weeks. And
okay.
That's pretty much it for us. So.
And yours is coming up now, isn't it?
Yeah, we're about a month away. So finally dusting the golf clubs off and trying to dedicate a little bit more time to some practice. But we'll see. But it's a little bit harder for me these days. I've got no status anymore. I lost the last little piece of pro-am order of merit status divisionally. So for here in WA about 2 years ago. So now it's just enter, hope I get a start. And yeah. Try and play well and play enough events to get that order of merit category back again.
Okay, so what's the lesson? I know you do speaking and corporate work as well. So, just to sort of to get us to the end, what is the lesson to learn from, you know, your like really interesting ride into? I mean, have you lost your self-belief? Have you? And how do you come back from, because obviously, I mean, I think it's amazing that you would go over there going, I'm just going to get on the tour, then get your head punched in and then go, oh shit, you know? And it's really interesting. It's a young man going, I've got this, to a young man sort of going, Jesus.
Yeah. So I was 24. Four at the time, I think 23 or 24 when I went to the US. So, and it was my first time in the States as well. So I think that, you know, being young and, as much as I was there for the golf, you discover the American people and that lifestyle of not so much college lifestyle, but you know, you go out and you socialize and you have a few drinks and no different to what we do here in Australia, but it's just, you're in another country. So it almost amplifies itself a little bit. And not that I was going out partying every night, but I guess I lost focus a little bit and there was initially that isolation of, right, you're here to play golf and that's all you're doing. Like, you're just going to work your ass off and play and practice and grind and make it to the tour and, yeah, live the high life essentially. But, I think, you know, the lesson in it all, you want to have self-belief. At the end of the day, you want to have self-belief and that's going to come and go regardless. And I think performance, not just as a golfer or as an athlete, but just in everyday life, you know, you're never going to be at your peak day in, day out, or even every hour through the day for that matter. So there's still going to be that level of self-belief, but having a process to be able to find that belief when you don't have it and almost having that little a trigger. So I guess for me, when I lose the self-belief, I actually stop practicing and I'll take a few days away from golf because I start to get into this technical mindset around my swing and I try and search for something that I don't need to search for. So I'll just step away and go, you know what, I'm not going to practice. It might be for a day. It might be for a week. Any longer than a week, I start to get the itch again. So, and then I'll just go back to basics on the range and just hit a few shots. Try and hit some shot shapes and play some silly shots. Do exactly what we used to do as kids. So it's, you know, trying to hit a 80-yard slingy hook across the driving range and try and hit a little flop shot that goes about 10 feet and play some chip shots from sandboxes and just all the stupid shots that, yeah, and almost try and find that enjoyment and find that fun. And I actually caught up with a good friend of mine a few weeks ago, and yeah, I was in a bit of a low around my golf and just with everything that's been going on. And he said to me, you know, like, he just said, why come back to finding why I do it for me, and not worry so much about trying to do things for everybody else, and make sure that what I'm doing and why I'm doing it is for myself, which sounds really selfish, but I think at the same time, we're so used to putting everybody else before us, whether it's for, you know, work or sport or a career, we just everything, yeah, you almost do it for everybody else. And that's the, you know, to make people like you, or, you know, make people want to follow your career, or, you know, that you want to do it for the money to be able to give the family the lifestyle that you think that they deserve. And yet at the same time, like, oh yeah, cool, like, money's great, and, you know, signing autographs is great, it might still not be why you actually want to do it.
What do you do with the young kids coming through your club? I mean, like, you have these really good kids who are 12, 13, and then, you know, distraction, which is great. That's what you're talking about, is, you know, like, because distraction's great. It's just a matter of, do you try and keep them on the course, or do you let them go and find their way back?
Yeah, look, I let them go. I like to try and just... I'll let them know that I'm there to support them, and you know, and I've got their back at the end of the day. Like, I've got four young kids at the moment. When I say young, they're sort of 16 to 18 that I'm working with on their games. But I almost look at my role with them as being a life coach, not just a golf coach. And yeah, if they've got something going on and they need someone to talk to, they can bounce that off me. And if they want to go out and drink, and they want to go out and party and do all that stuff when they're away for a tournament, great. But you've also got to understand that there's consequences to that, not so much through me as your golf coach, but to people around you, whether that's mum and dad are going to get the shits that you've gone out and got smashed, but you're away for a tournament. You know, the other people around you, some of these kids have got their club supporting them, or the state association supporting them as well. So I think, you know, you want to keep them close, but also let them have their own space and let them find themselves as well. And as I said, I think a lot of parents, especially with really good golfers, it's just, this is how it is. You know, you're going to go and practice, you're going to go to golf, you're going to come home and do your schoolwork, and they just don't get to have a life. And eventually there's going to be that tipping point, and whether it's when they turn 18 and they can go out and start drinking, or they turn 21, or, you know, in my case, 24 and go to America, and you know, you kind of get that, you're away from it. They can't protect you anymore. So it's, but it's hard now, like, you know, for kids these days on social media, like, you can't, or not even kids, but for all of us, you can't really put a foot out of line, because what goes on, well, it's, yeah, we used to say what goes on tour stays on tour, but it's what goes on tour goes on social media. So there's, I think, teaching them to have that self-awareness to at least go, you know, like, your own person, go and have fun, but stay committed, but also know that, you know, there's a camera's always watching, there's, you know, recorder's always recording.
Stop it, just don't
be too silly,
just be a good human being.
Yeah. Just, like, don't do something that your grandmother wouldn't be proud of.
Oh, okay. Good advice. Yeah. All right. So, and for you now, like, where do you, you've got your coaching and your pro-am circuit coming up. So hopefully you start there. And
yeah. So now for me, it's mainly just coaching. I still have that passion and that desire to play, and yeah, I guess I hold out hope that maybe one day I'll have that one good tournament, because that's really all it takes in golf, is that one good week, and it sets yourself up. So,
the devil comes to visit you and he says, "Hey, listen, Glenn, I tell you what, you're gonna have one good tournament. I'm gonna give you one, right? That's it. What would it be?"
Ooh,
I don't know why it's the devil.
Yeah. Well, it is the opposite to the golfing gods, because the golfing gods are never really on our side, are they? But look, I think in Australia, Aussie Open, I think having your own national championship is pretty big. I always look at the Aussie Open as just that one tournament I've never really been able to get over the hurdle and qualify for. I always gassed it in Aussie Open qualifying.
So when you're coming down the last, you got two shots. You got a 2-shot lead. What are the commentators saying about you? So you know they do that dicky thing of go, you know, Glenn Paul. He's a kid from, you know, Fairlight Gardens. In what are they saying about you? How are they going to wrap you up? Sorry, Macquarie Fields.
Yeah, 2-5-6-4. I think it'd be that journeyman, the guy that's just been grinding his whole life, looking and waiting for that taste of success. And hopefully I don't 3-putt the last to lose by one. We'll roll one in and win by a shot. Be nice. But definitely I think just that, the journeyman that's just been never kind of lost sight of the journey. It's been a wild ride getting there, but never really lost sight of what it is that I've wanted to achieve.
Okay. Well, all the best, Glenn. Thanks very much for your time.
Andrew, thanks for having me on, mate.
Thanks, Glenn.
Hey, no worries. Thank you, mate.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
In the background there, you can hear the dulcet tones of the ocean breaking onto the shore, because my other passion is ocean swimming, and I'm an Aquarian and I like raging. So if I was auditioning for Perfect Match, that's what I would have said. I like golf, ocean swimming and raging. That would have been my thing. Anyway, look, one of the guys I swim with rang me yesterday and said with great excitement that he's cured his slice. Not only that, he can hit a draw. He's a lifetime slicer, but apparently no longer. His name's David. Dave, what? So just what happened? Like, just because you're our lesson today, even though as an amateur golfer, playing off
18, I've had a slice forever.
Yeah.
And you get sick of it. You play the right side of the fairway the whole time. All your mates are in the middle or on the left. They go further. So I search the internet for tips.
Right. So do you go on, you Google how to hit a draw, or?
I Googled how to get rid of your slice and hit a draw. Right. And the tip was, it's very, very simple. Like, if you think about it, you stand there, shoulders square, you aim down the middle of the fairway, and you hit the ball. No matter how well you hit it, it goes to the right. But, the tip was...
Hang on. So that's your theory, is regardless of where you stand or how you stand, it's always going right.
It is always going right. And you always stand the same way, where your feet and your shoulders all line up for where you want it to go. You hit it, and it fades and slices. But the tip was... If you pretend you've got an arrow following your toes and the ball in your club straight down the fairway, that's your normal line of hitting it. But if you swing the club so it goes at like 25 degrees from the ball out to the right, it stops you swinging inside out, I think it's called. It means you come around the ball a little bit. And for the first time ever, a bucket of balls at the driving range that are all going straight or drawing. It's easier to show a little diagram, but pretend there's a line through your toes and the ball is little red line goes to where you want to go.
So go in the
pick the target.
Right, which is straight down the middle of the
fairway.
Yeah.
Straight down the middle of the fairway where you never ever go. But when you
do you think you've got an attitudinal issue with the way you play? Like, just by using phrase, so people would argue that by saying where you never ever go, that you're actually killing yourself anyway.
Absolutely. When I stand in front of the water, I'm not going in the water. Boop! Straight in the water.
Right.
If I stand on the fairway, I'm going straight down the middle, I'm in the trees on the right.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you've got a little red line.
Little red line. And then you do this dotted line across the top at like 25 degrees over from the ball. And it makes you swing around the club. Your hips get engaged. And the ball goes to the left. It's amazing. Amazing.
So 25 degrees from your feet out.
If you've got a line, your little red line, toes, ball, straight down the middle of the fairway, that's where you want to go. Hit 25 degrees. You swing your club 25 degrees to the right.
Right, so out. Right. So you're going for an in-to-out swing.
If that's what the pros call it.
I don't know what you call it. So
it's fucking unreal. the non-technical jargon there. It makes you swing around the ball instead of through the ball. So if you're a tennis player, it's a bit like a topspin shot where you come around the ball and it works.
Right. Great. So you're excited, clearly. Have you taken it to the course yet?
Absolutely.
Oh, and what happened?
Down the left all day. Never been there in my life.
Right. And with your irons as well?
Yeah.
It's not just the wood. It's...
No, well, it was mainly my driver I was practicing with. Irons didn't have so much an issue with my slice, but yes, they were going a little bit right to left, which is unusual.
Well, I'm thrilled that you've been able to give our coaching segment today as an 18 handicapper. I hope that makes sense. It makes sense for you, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I'm back. Watch out, mate. I'm going to outdrive you next time we see each other. You'll be in my wake.
Oh, because now we're swimming again. All right. Thanks, Dave.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.